Hi, I'm Carmen LaBurge. Thanks for listening to the podcast of Mornings with Carmen LaBurge.
Today is the day you have made. I will rejoice and be glad in it. Today is the day you have made. I will rejoice and be glad in it. And I won't worry about tomorrow. I'm trusting.
Indeed, today is the day. Good morning. Sorry, I have a little bit of a, it sounds like I haven't slept, but I have. I have a little bit of a froggy voice this morning. Don't really know why that is. I hope you are feeling blessed and awake and alert this morning and charging into this Tuesday with joy and expectation of all the ways in which God intends to use you. Like, that's, you are an instrument, you are a vessel, you are a conduit. You're a minister. You're an agent of grace. You might even feel today like you need to be a super agent of grace because it's feeling like we need some super grace in the world today. Here's the good news. God's grace is all sufficient. It never runs out. There's always more than enough of it. And you and I have the opportunity to be agents of that grace in the world today. And so, you know, as you are putting on the full armor of God today in the spirit of Ephesians chapter 6, I want you to think of the superhero nature of your agency. Like, right, you are an agent of grace. You're an ambassador of the kingdom of heaven, and you are in the world an agent of grace today. And so, you know, what, as an agent of grace, what are your secret weapons? Well, let's lead off with, you have full access to the Father. Full access to the Father through the Son by the power of the Holy Spirit. And so don't fail to go to the Father and get what you need in order that you could walk into the world that he so loves with all of the wisdom and all of the grace that is going to be necessary for the meeting of the challenges that he knows are before you this day. God's already prepared in advance every good work that he intends for you to do. God has already tilled the soil before you. Where he intends for you to plant the seed of his word in the lives of others. God already knows where he intends to send you as a peacemaker. God already knows. So you and I who have full access to him, why wouldn't we go to him and say, okay, so God, because you already know, Father, maybe you could help me to be patient and confident and gracious and calm in the midst of whatever you know is ahead of me today. You've got another secret weapon, and that's prayer. And I just demonstrated how simple it is to, in the spirit of Christ, because he has given us the access, how simple it is for us to go to the Father and just simply tell him what we need. So let me encourage you today to not overcomplicate the reality of prayer. I encourage people to do something called open-eyed prayer. If you've never practiced open-eyed prayer, it's what you should be doing. It's the kind of prayer you should be doing at all times in all places, particularly when you're driving. So open-eyed prayer is what I would encourage you to do. So as you are, let's say you see an emergency vehicle or you hear an emergency vehicle and it starts to clog up traffic where you are. Maybe that's a great time to pray for the people whose lives have now been possibly forever changed by the incident that is now disrupting your commute. And so open-eyed prayer is with eyes wide open to the concerns of the world and the concerns of others, that we would pray for them, that we would pray in the midst of every circumstance, that God's redeeming power would find its way into human life, into human lives, and that God would choose to use us as instruments today in making that happen, in revealing his redemptive power and presence and glory to others. All right. First up this morning, Tommy Binion from the Daily Signal at the Heritage Foundation. He and I are going to continue to till the soil on the subject of immigration. We may touch on DACA. We may touch on border facilities and deportations. We are certainly going to talk about immigration law, and we're going to try to frame the conversation in a meaningful way. So that's up next here on Mornings with Carmen.
I'm just a bill. Yes, I'm only a bill. And I'm sitting here on Capitol Hill. Well, it's a long, long journey to the Capitol City.
Well, good morning, Tommy. Welcome back to Mornings with Carmen.
Great to be back with you.
Okay, so I'm hoping you are not like trapped in flooding in Washington, D.C. I'm hoping that you are somewhere more idyllic.
Well, I think it has subsided. I'm right here at home in Washington. But yesterday, you know, flash flooding is just – it's a phenomenon. You can't believe how fast that water comes up. It's 5 or 10 seconds, and it's knee or hip deep. And that was, for those listening that don't know, that happened about the time that most Washingtonians were commuting to work yesterday. So it was a real madhouse yesterday morning around here.
Yeah, so we're just the cleanup will be long because people will have all kinds of personal items and cars and all manner of such things. So anyway, but just praying that everybody is safe and that the cleanup goes well. And for those of us who have been in parts of the country that have experienced flooding, we are knowingly nodding our heads and recognizing the challenges that now face folks in the greater Washington area related to yesterday's flooding. Hey, let's talk a little bit about immigration. I'm actually willing to go this morning any direction you want to, because my list includes general conversation about immigration, but then also legislation related to the Dreamers or DACA, conversations about what's going on the border, particularly in border facilities. I know the president yesterday alluded to the opportunity for, you know, us to get eyes in those places via the media. And then there's all kinds of conversation about, you know, active deportations of people who have deportation orders, who are in the country, you know, in unauthorized ways. So where do you want to start? Because we could pull any of these threads today.
Yeah, so I think all of those threads are relevant. I think the fact that they are all, just about everything you mentioned, is headline news this morning, is part of the reason that immigration is the number one issue on people's minds as we enter this 2020 campaign. I think that's fascinating. That hasn't happened before. Even when Donald Trump was candidate the first time around, immigration wasn't the very tippy-top issue. It is now. And it's for those reasons that you mentioned. I want to start at the border. That's where immigration starts. We are facing a wave of illegal immigration at the border. Some folks would refer to this as an asylum crisis, a humanitarian and security crisis, whatever you call it. Here's what's happened. People in Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador, that's the Northern Triangle, are wanting to come to the United States. The security and economic situation in those countries is such that you would want to flee and come here. They've got to take a very dangerous journey to get here, and along the way, perhaps they are coached on manipulating our asylum laws. When they arrive at the border, if they come to a point of entry, or if they are arrested somewhere between points of entry trying to cross the border illegally, they'll claim asylum. Some huge percentage of folks who claim asylum are granted what's called credible fear, which means you're going to get a court date some a year or two from now. And in the meantime, you're going to be admitted into the United States. Once you're admitted, you will get work authorization. And so, but 90% of those people who are allowed to come in based on credible fear are not ultimately granted asylum. Anyways, it's a fairly easy process, and hundreds of thousands of people have decided to go to the border and go through this process, so much so that the system is overwhelmed. It's overwhelmed especially by children and families, and that's where the conditions come in that we're hearing about. Many of these people are kept in detainment facilities for a short time while that credible fear interview is processed, or in the case of a child, while the United States government locates a suitable adult to house them with, while those types of things are going on. So in the interim, they're kept in facilities which are not at all in any way equipped to deal with this crisis, equipped to deal with the numbers of children and family that are coming across and the length of time that they're staying. And so conditions have been heartbreaking. There's no other way to say that. The pictures will pull at your heartstrings. But this isn't, I don't think, an instance of cruelty on behalf of the United States government or anything like that. The system is simply overwhelmed. The good news is the Congress has passed a spending bill to help deal with it. The president signed that into law on July the 1st. The bad news is that what is causing this is our broken asylum law, and it is still in place, and prospects of changing it in a divided Congress in the United States are bleak. And so I think while the numbers may subside as the heat goes up, I think this crisis is going to persist until the laws are changed. And I'm not sure that can happen until after the election. So I'll stop there and let you react to that.
Well, I think, first of all, very helpful observations and a helpful explanation of what is happening. I think that for folks who want, I mean, literally, like, just the facts, just the numbers, I'm going to direct them today to pewresearch.org on their fact tank site. There are just a list of key facts about U.S. immigration policies. And then there's a good conversation there about, you know, some proposed changes. And so if you want more information about what Tommy just walked through, if you want to understand, you know, like the difference between a refugee and an asylum seeker, or the difference between family-based immigration and employee-based green cards or diversity visas or HB, you're going to hear H-1B visas a lot. You're gonna hear about DACA. Maybe you don't know what all of those things are. Maybe temporary protected status, which we have talked about here on the show in the past in relationship to immigrants from certain places where there were natural disasters, and we offered people temporary protected status that should have run out many, many years ago, but is just really not a well-managed part of our immigration program. So Pew Research has an interesting piece. It's just called Key Facts about U.S. Immigration Policies and Proposed Changes. There's lots of those around the web, but I wanted to offer one up that is, you know, seemingly as nonpartisan as possible, which you and I both know isn't really possible at all today. So everything seems to feel slightly partisan in these conversations. Tommy Binion and I are going to come right back, and we're going to talk, we're going to touch on the subject of socialism. And a woman who survived China's forced labor camps and is now urging Americans to reject socialism. So that conversation up next here with Tommy Binion from the Daily Signal. You're listening to Mornings with Carmen. Whatever you do, just don't look back. Somebody needs a lot to have. Whatever you do, just don't lose heart. Keep on pushing back the door. Continuing my conversation with Tommy Binion from the Heritage Foundation's Daily Signal, and on the Daily Signal website, which you can find at dailysignal.com, there is an article entitled "She Survived China's Forced Labor Camp. Now She's Urging Americans to Reject Socialism." I just really want you, if you're willing, Tommy, to share this story with our listeners.
Sure. So I would encourage everyone to go. It is a podcast interview, and the transcript is right there in the article as well. But my colleague Rob Bluey interviewed. Her name is Jennifer Fang, and she was born in communist China, but she was a part of a religious group called the Falun Gong, who was a religious group that was persecuted by the Chinese state. And she was forced into labor concentration camps. And I think that the horrors that go along with that are well known to many. But I think the point of the story, and there's another story in the same article, a gentleman who escaped as an infant, communist Ukraine. But here's the point. The point is, as socialism comes back in favor, or as some segment of the American people are attracted to socialism and some of the political talking points that go along with it, it's a reminder of the atrocities committed by communist and socialist states in the past and in present day throughout the globe. I think candidates on the left that are highlighting what the benefits of socialism might be to an individual, certainly not the nation, but they might be to one or two individuals that are listening to those candidates, this is a vivid reminder of where those ideologies can lead and the problems that are associated with them that come every time. These aren't examples, one-off examples, or examples when a communist or socialist government went off the rails. This is where they end every time. They end
right.
in these human tragedies.
This is the
and
pattern.
That's the point. Yeah.
Yeah. If people want to know what is produced through socialism, these are testimonies of people from places where socialism has been tried, is being tried, continues to be tried in some cases, and it is failing. It's failing the people. It's a good opportunity for us to learn the stories of where it has been tried and where it has failed in order that we could be equipped for the conversations of our day in relationship to those who are proposing it as an alternative, to capitalism here. Okay, so let's now shift gears if we can, because you have another piece posted at the Daily Signal, which I found very intriguing. We fought the transgender activist and lost, which is going to be like a shocking surprise to some people, although a true statement. Here are five lessons for every parent. So this is by your colleague, Kristen Allen. And I thought this was really, really fascinating. And this notion that we've essentially lost this conversation in terms of the culture is really evidence of our ineffectiveness in terms of being equipped to engage in truthful conversation in a way that doesn't just cave into feelings all the time. But I think she makes a right observation that's really in many ways lost. Walk us through some of these lessons that we either have learned or still need to learn in terms of what is effective in terms of cultural engagement.
Right. And so as a parent, this is something I worry about. This is something that, keeps me up at night. This article is about a group of parents in Arlington, a suburb of Washington, who faced a school board decision that the transgender ideology and all that goes along with it would be implemented in those schools. That means transgender identified children would be allowed to use the restroom of their choice. Girls would have to play sports against transgender girls or transgender boys. The compelled speech by the schools would force students into using certain pronouns for certain children, and on the list goes. And so there was a brave group of parents that fought this, but what they faced, the opposition that they faced, was incredibly fervent and in your face, and was disheartening to them. So some of the lessons they go through. One of my favorite, the first one: courage is contagious. And the idea there is that there are many who fear this ideology. There are many who want to fight back against our children being taught these wrong ideas in schools, but they don't have the courage to do so because, of course, the first thing that will happen if you open your mouth is you will be called a bigot. And while that's not true, while you're protecting your kids, that is a really tough thing to stand up to, but it's easier in numbers. And when people, like you said, have honest conversations, they can identify other people who are willing to band together with them. I think other lessons that they learned were about building alliances, and that people across religions and across ideologies and across races and across, immigrant parents being involved, and every parent that is interested being involved in fighting back against this. But I think the most important lesson, and I'm not sure she said this explicitly, but is as parents, you've got to be involved. You've got to pay attention. You cannot assume that it's all going to work out fine. You cannot. The last one is we are in a post opt-out culture. You cannot assume that they will pass rules that will allow you to opt your child out of a course or something like that. This is a battle that you are in as a parent to make sure that your child is taught the truth, and you have to be engaged and involved in that. I think we're called to do that as believers. And I think that is a terrifying thought, to be honest with you, but it is a true thought.
All right, Tommy, you and I are going to have to leave it right there. Let's send people to dailysignal.com to read the article. We fought the transgender activist and lost. Here are five lessons for every parent. I think it's an excellent, excellent reminder and good witness and testimony. Tommy Binion, thank you so much for joining us again today.
Thank you for having me. Have a great show.
Thanks. We'll be right back. Okay, so I think it's fair to say that none of us wants to be called bigoted. And when we use that word, we must at some point think about race. And we have to ask the question about race in our culture. And so we're going to have a conversation about something called critical race theory. Now, it actually grows out of the legal world. And so there are lots of words in critical race theory that are, you know, frankly, outside of the common conversational parlance of most of us. You have probably heard the term white privilege. You have probably heard the term microaggression. You probably don't even really know what all the microaggressions are. But, you know, is racism institutionalized? If so, how are people experiencing it? What is social construction? What is intersectionality? And when we talk about critical race theory, you may be saying to yourselves, I don't need to know anything about that. Well, it's now a part of the educational system in our country, and it's certainly a part of higher education. And so we're going to have a conversation about critical race theory. So brace yourself, because this is like this is meat first thing in the morning. So this is a little bit of a tough conversation to have, and it's a meaty one, but we're going to have it. Critical race theory up next here on Mornings with Carmen. Okay, so there's a free online course available right now if you go to myfaithradio.com. It's called Navigating Grief with Humor. Tomorrow is the very last day you can sign up. So I'm encouraging you to go to myfaithradio.com today, sign up for this free online course. If you've ever, you know, like wondered to yourself, okay, I know humor has its place. I would love to be able to comfort a grieving friend or colleague and be able to do so in a way that's not, you know, frankly, just wallowing in sadness. This is that kind of equipping. Humor does have its place, but it can also be hurtful. And so this helps us find the rightful place of the use of humor when we are walking through grief ourselves or walking through grief with others. And so please join us at myfaithradio.com for Navigating Grief with Humor.
How much is your enough? This is Callie Breeze with your Thrivent Money Journey Moment. The world answers that question with the old adage, just a little bit more. But Proverbs 30 offers wisdom to help us think about this most difficult question. The writer says, "Give me neither poverty nor riches, but only my daily bread. Otherwise, I may have too much and disown you. Or I may become poor and steal and so dishonor the name of my God." So, how do you answer the question, what's your enough? It's not easy, because we live in a world that tells us more is better. At Thrivent, we know it's important for you as a Christian to know you're enough. When you know it, you can live a more content, confident, and generous life. So I'll ask you again, what's your enough?
So I'm joined today by Neil Shenvey. You can check out what he's doing at Shenvey. That's S-H-E-N-V-I, ShenveyApologetics.com. Neil, welcome to Mornings with Carmen.
Great. Thanks, Carmen.
So this conversation about critical theory is going to require that we take a step back and actually define what critical theory is. So in the setup to this conversation, basically, what I have asked people is, you know, are you interested in, have you heard, are you wondering about terms like cisgender, intersectionality, heteronormativity, centering, white fragility, these kinds of words, and do you want to know what those are a part of? And they are all a part of this thing called critical theory. Can you tell us what that is?
Sure. Critical theory is a very broad and diverse ideology that spans disciplines. So it's kind of hard to define exactly what critical theory is, but I think you can pick out some core concepts. So let me read a quote from Heather Davidson. She writes, "Since its inception, since the beginning, critical theory has been primarily concerned with the elimination of oppression and the promotion of justice. Liberation is a theme that runs through critical theory, liberation from objective oppressors, and liberation from subjective forces such as mass culture and ideology." So it's all about dividing the world into oppressed groups and their oppressors and seeking to free or liberate the oppressed.
Which sounds like a good thing.
Yeah, that's right. Many Christians hear those words and think, oh yeah, of course the Bible tells us, commands us even to resist oppression, to seek justice, care for the vulnerable. But you have to understand that critical theory defines these words in very different ways than Christians ought to.
So we should pause there and we should say, okay, so everything in critical theory isn't wrong or false, because there are some things that are affirmed in critical theory that we should recognize about ourselves and our systems, but it doesn't get everything right. And so this is really an exercise in serious discernment.
Yes, very much so. In fact, I would say that while it gets some things right, it gets some things fundamentally wrong. The core concepts in critical theory are just antithetical to a Christian worldview. For example, they define oppression not as unjust or cruel treatment or control, things like slavery, theft, violence. That's oppression. But primarily, oppression to a critical theorist means that you're under what's called a hegemonic discourse. So anyone who imposes their values or norms or expectations on culture has hegemonic power. And that would mean that any group that has these norms imposed on them is oppressed. So here's another quote from Jacob Kroos. "A concept of hegemony, that is the control of culture and norms, that enables us to appreciate how dominant groups," that would be whites, men, the rich, heterosexuals, "they manipulate symbols and images to construct quote-unquote common sense and thereby maintain their power. Such groups increasingly are defined and understood not only in terms of class, but also in terms of gender, race, sexual orientation, and so forth." So you see there that they would group racism and sexism in the same category as homophobia, transphobia, all these different categories, and they would all be called oppression, which we have to dismantle.
Okay, so this is a deep, complicated subject matter area. Let me be sure that folks know that they can go to shenviapologetics.com. Shenvi is S-H-E-N-V-I, apologetics.com, where Neil Shenvi really does unpack a lot of this. He's got tons of content on critical theory. Neil, tell people a little bit about yourself and why you're passionate about this subject.
Sure. I am just passionate about apologetics. And so I learned all the classical ideas in apologetics, how to show that God exists, how to show the Bible is trustworthy, how to show people that the resurrection happened. But a few years ago, I noticed that people were less concerned about whether Christianity was true or false, and were more concerned with questions of whether it was marginalizing people. And even Christians, I noticed, were sometimes moving from concerns about social justice, which I thought meant applying the Bible to social concerns and to laws, and that's a good thing. They moved from being concerned with social justice to these beliefs that were increasingly unorthodox regarding sexuality, gender, even religious exclusivity. You have people that became atheists because they felt, well, it's marginalizing to believe that Christianity is the one way to God. I can't accept that. It must be false. And I said, well, what's that connection? It makes no sense. And I realized, sort of reading books about critical theory, and thought, oh, there's an entire worldview behind these ideas that is in conflict with Christianity. And as we embrace the worldview of critical theory, we'll have to just reject multiple fundamental Christian ideas.
Okay, so we're going to get to this worldview question in just a minute. But I want to say this about you. So for folks who are listening, Neil is the furthest thing from like a slouch that you could ever find in all of the world. So trained as an academic scientist, this is now what he is engaged in, is Christian apologetics. So he completed his undergraduate studies at Princeton. He did a PhD in theoretical chemistry, which I don't even know what that is, at the University of California at Berkeley. Okay, so this is Neil is a guy who has been in environments where the concepts of like intersectionality, this is the main course of the menu at many of these institutions of higher learning across the country. He then went on to do postdoctoral research at both Yale and Duke. Again, not slouchy institutions. In 2015, he actually left his job at Duke to do what? To do what? What did you leave your job at Duke to focus on? Because this is the part of your story that I love.
Sure. I'm homeschooling my four kids right now.
Okay. I have my hands like raised in the air. I'm like, what? What? Who does that? Who leaves the kind of worldly opportunities that were set, you know, in front of you and for which you prepared academically to focus on instilling in the next generation an understanding of that which is good, beautiful, and true? I know you're an advocate of classical Christian education. So am I. And I just did not want to miss that in our conversation together. So when we come back, I'm going to continue my conversation with Neil Shenvey. We are talking about Christianity and critical race theory. If you've wondered what those words mean, today's the day we're talking about that and how critical race theory is actually incompatible with the Christian worldview. So that conversation continues next with Neil Shenvey.
Ask me how I'm doing, I'm blessed. Yes, living every moment, no regrets.
Okay, picking up where we left off with Neil Shenvey on Christianity and critical race theory. Neil, we have talked a little bit about the things in critical theory that can be affirmed. You have talked about hegemony and this hegemonic power. I think we better define that for our listeners.
Sure. So hegemonic power is the power that people have, that the dominant groups have to define norms, values, and expectations on culture. So they impose their values on society and make everyone think that this is these ideas are true and good and they're common sense. And so, for example, critical theorists will say that our concept that being a male is normal, being female is aberrant, or being white is normal, it's the default, being a person of color is aberrant, it's abnormal. Those ideas are a form of hegemonic power, and that power is inherently oppressive. And it's sort of, a hegemonic discourse is the story that the ruling class tells other people to justify their own dominance. It's the narrative they spin to say, well, this is why we're in power. We deserve it.
Hmm. Okay. So tell us, let's have the worldview conversation. We often talk worldview here on the program. I'm actually a person who resists biblical worldview or Christian worldview in favor of gospel worldview. I would really like people to have a gospel worldview because I think that other words get us, we trip up on them so frequently. Talk about critical race theory or critical theory in general as a worldview. How does it operate as a worldview?
Sure. So just quickly, there's a distinction between critical race theory and critical theory. The former, critical race theory, is critical theory sort of applied to race and has its own methodologies and concerns. Critical theory is the broader, more general ideology, just to make that clear. So as a worldview, as we said, critical theory views reality through the lens of oppressor versus oppressed, and the oppressors have hegemonic power. They have the ability to control and create narratives that justify their own oppression. One big problem with that is that the Bible is just one gigantic, colossal hegemonic discourse from Genesis to Revelation, right? It's a big story about how God is completely justified in having all authority, all power. He exerts his power over us. He imposes his norms and values and expectations on us through his law. And all of that is supposedly a good thing. But critical theory would see that as inherently oppressive. He's oppressing us. He's the ultimate oppressor in a sense because he's imposing his values on us.
Okay, so as a Christian, I immediately say, whoa, whoa, whoa. My understanding of who God is isn't just based on scripture. That's a huge part of it. But I also have this personal experience with the Holy Spirit. I actually have, I don't feel as if in any way God is oppressing me by his sovereignty. I certainly do not in any way view God as somebody who imposes himself on anyone. God invites us into a restored relationship with himself through a sacrifice that he made on our behalf. Help me understand how God ends up being the ultimate oppressor in a conversation where God is ultimately the one who took on human flesh, condescended to my reality, died for me on the cross in order that I might be offered ultimate liberation, both here and forevermore.
Right, but it goes back to the understanding of oppression. If you define oppression as being having values imposed on you by some dominant group or some dominant person, then that is oppression, whether it feels that way or not. And moreover, critical theory would say that people that are oppressed often don't know it. They have internalized oppression. And so they can think, they can actually accede to this hegemonic discourse and say, well, sure, they're right. You know, they deserve to be in power, just like you're saying that about God. But they would see that as a function of your blindness as a person who's been dominated. You have to wake up and achieve a liberatory consciousness. You have to have your consciousness raised in order to grasp that you're actually being oppressed by God or by men or by heterosexuals or by whites or by some other group that has this hegemonic power. So it takes work to actually realize you're being oppressed.
Okay, you literally just you just transported me back in time to when I walked onto the campus of Princeton Seminary, that which is where I went to graduate school. And a woman whose name is Faith, who is now a professor at an Ivy League institution, she told me that unless my consciousness was raised, I was not going to be able to understand what they were doing at the Women's Center. And I said, what? And she said, well, clearly you need to have your consciousness. She'd been to Brown. I'd gone to the University of Florida. So clearly my consciousness was not raised in the same way that hers had been. And I said, look, here's the deal, Faith. My consciousness is raised to the level of Christ. If you think you've got a consciousness that goes beyond or above Christ, we have a whole different conversation to have about why you are at a seminary. Like, for me, the confusion is completely reversed. The blinders are completely on the other set of eyes. The spiritual oppression and the delusion is not. I am liberated. Like, right, this is part of the challenge of this conversation when we try to engage this. Is that we are literally people as Christians who have seen the truth, who know the truth, who've been set free by the truth. And we want that for other people. But the people with whom we are seeking to engage at this level actually see us as blind and oppressed. This is hard. Engagement on this subject is hard.
Right. Yeah. And it is working its way into the evangelical just consciousness. I mean, I think we're starting to think in these terms that, yes, we're blinded. We have to have our consciousness raised by these marginalized groups. And I think, while we want to be very humble and aware that we do have blind spots, we do have to, as you said, realize that, you know, Christ once and for all enlightened us. Christ gave us his Holy Spirit, and that's sufficient. And we shouldn't be proud and arrogant and say, therefore, I don't have anything to learn from, say, even critical theory. But I have to say, it's a fundamentally different worldview that approaches truth not through the lens of, scripture, but through the lens of power, and power determines whether or not you have access to the truth or not, or whether you're blind.
Mm. Okay, so give us a couple talking points, walking points in terms of engaging this topic with others.
Yeah, I'd say if you're talking to a non-Christian, I think you have to just reassert the primacy of truth. Like, is Christianity true? And if it is, it doesn't really matter whether you like it or not, or whether you feel like it's oppressive. It just is true. That's number one. Number two, I would preach the gospel, point out that we worship a God who took on human flesh, who was himself actually oppressed and afflicted. That's what Isaiah 53 says. So we don't worship a God who's indifferent to actual injustice, but we worship a God who tells us that his power is used to lift up and free the oppressed. And ultimately, our real problem is not human oppression, but sin. And sin infects the rich, the poor, blacks, whites, Asians, everybody, men and women, equally. And we have to be freed from sin's power, not by activism, but by Jesus, by the gospel. So that's for non-Christians. For Christians, I would just point out that they have to recognize that critical theory really is a worldview. And you can't practice some kind of syncretism where you are both a Christian and embrace critical theory wholeheartedly. There's going to be numerous points where they conflict, and the more you try to accommodate both unreflectively, the less you're going to be able to embrace biblical Christianity. You're going to be forced to choose between the two of them with regard to all kinds of things, whether it's values or ethics or priorities, and it's going to gradually eat away at your Christian worldview.
Neil, I think that talking with you is an intellectual feast. I'm going to invite people to visit you online at Shenvi Apologetics, S-H-E-N-V-I, shenviapologetics.com. Read what Neil's got posted at thegospelcoalition.org. Thank you so much for joining us today on Mornings with Carmen.
It's my pleasure, Carmen. Thank you.
All right, friends, I got to take a quick break, and then we'll be right back. Okay, so I don't know about you, but I learned a lot during that conversation with Neil Shenvey. One of the most important things that I probably learned that I now need to go back and till the soil on and study more is the distinction that he made in the middle of our conversation between critical theory and critical race theory, or how critical theory is applied to the conversation about race, because they actually are distinct, different conversations. And so forgive me for the way that at the beginning of our conversation, I actually assumed, I made assumptions about the way those two things were related, and I might have confused that issue for some of you. So critical theory is really the substance of what he's talking about as it applies to race. That is a bit of a different conversation. So we might have to till that soil with Neil or someone else in a later conversation to be sure that, you know, gosh, I have all those threads pulled out correctly. So a shout out to those of you on the text line this morning. Yes, indeed. Thank you for the reminder from 1 Corinthians chapter 1. The foolishness of God is wiser than men. The weakness of God stronger than men. The preaching of the cross is to them who perish foolishness, but unto us who are being saved, it is the very power of God. Yes, indeed. And then a little from a little bit earlier, someone wanted me to be sure that everyone was equipped today with Hebrews chapter 13, verses 20 to 22. Where in the word are you today? Some of our listeners are in Hebrews 13, 20 to 22. I'd invite you to visit there as well. You're listening to Mornings with Carmen. We'll be right back.
Thanks for listening to this podcast of Mornings with Carmen LaBurge from Faith Radio. If you haven't, you can subscribe to automatically receive the podcast through iTunes or the Google Play Music app. That way, you never miss an episode. It's also available anytime at myfaithradio.com.